So we have a very interesting, very exciting announcement.
Yeah, so one thing that's exciting for the field and for this program, as was pointed out to me by Dr. Trips, the Buckley Prize was announced today, and it's going to Charlie Kane, Lawrence Mollenkamp, and Xucheng Zhang for their work on the quantum spinola. People is here at the moment, but all of them will be coming by later in the program. So you might try to do something social, but in fairness, we should probably wait until they're here. Anyway, so now's a good chance to explain some of what that's all about, although I'm going to focus mostly on the three-dimensional topological insulator, which came a tiny bit later. And the first half of this talk will be pretty pedagogical. Axion electrodynamics is a term borrowed from particle physics to try and get some people to show up. What that really means is magnetoelectric effect, and a particular kind of quantized magnetoelectric effect. And then the second part will be about trying to find the universal description of topological insulators. So this is work with a large number of people over the years at Berkeley. In particular, for the second part of this talk, Gil-Young Cho is kind of the hero, and he's currently a graduate fellow here, so he's here all semester. The first part of the talk will involve a large number of these people, especially Andrew Essen, who's now a postdoc at Colorado. So as the pedagogical part, I want to give a picture of what topological insulators are that is slightly different from what you heard from Charlie and from Andreas, and in particular, how they connect to a long-standing program, which is the importance of the Berry phase in solids. So probably the first case where the Berry phase was really important for electrons in solids was the quantum Hall effect, and that was understood by Thallus et al. Even before Berry's paper. But it turns out that more and more things in solids, including topological insulators, can be understood as a Berry phase of the block electron. So in electrons in general, so I'll try to explain that. Then the magnetoelectric response is a particular effect, and it turns out that there's a nice spin-off of work on topological insulators. As an outgrowth of work on that problem, one understands something about magnetoelectric coupling in all materials, which is a nice classic problem, and it turns out to be very geometrical. And then finally, the last part of the talk is newer, and that's about trying to find some theory that describes topological insulators and maybe even fractional topological insulators in the way that Chern-Simons theory describes the quantum Hall effect. So that the connection between that and other constructions of fractional topological insulators is one of the open problems I'll mention, but I'll talk about one particular kind of field theory called a BF theory. So topological order, one way to describe it is a kind of order that is not symmetry breaking. So I think everyone in this audience knows what symmetry breaking is. If I look at a crystal, it has a lot of symmetries. It has a lot of rotations and translations, but it has fewer than the vacuum because, for example, the translational symmetry group is no longer continuous. Now, the one kind of symmetry breaking that you might want to think a bit about for this talk is magnetism. So magnetism not only picks out some direction in spin space and breaks the spin symmetry, but we also think of it as breaking time reversal. And the real key to all the work in topological insulators going back to 2004 or so was understanding what are the consequences of time reversal symmetry for electrons. So of course, the first example of topological order goes back to 1980. If you do a very standard measurement in solids, which is put on a magnetic field, run a current in one direction, and measure how much voltage builds up transverse to it, you normally get some information about the sign of the charge carriers and their density, but you normally get a straight line in a plot like this. Instead, if you do this with a two-dimensional electron gas, you get these incredible plateaus that are flat to about one part in a billion, and the Hall conductance on a plateau, that is the conductance in the transverse direction, is an integer times e squared over h to very high accuracy. So there are also fractional plateaus, and I'll come back to that a little bit later, very briefly. But for the integer quantum Hall effect, the main puzzle is just to explain why is this quantization so precise. So before von Klitzing's experiment, people knew that there would be features at multiples of e squared over h, but I don't think anyone realized just how precise this would be. So what protects it? So the answer is going to be topological order. And in the first part of this talk, I want to give two fairly simple definitions, and then a third definition comes up in the third part of the talk. The theorist definition is that something I can measure is given by a topological invariant, basically a mathematical quantity that's very stable to continuous deformations. And the more practical definition, which is how these phases are typically measured, is that the ones that we have very good experimental evidence for, at least, are gapped in the bulk. So essentially, the bulk is pretty inert, unless you do some quite complicated experiment like braiding. But they have a metallic edge or surface state whenever I put that bulk next to an ordinary bulk, like an ordinary insulator or the vacuum. So I want to sketch how these two are connected, although to make the connection precise, one has to think about responses like in Andreas's talk. But I want to explain a little bit what is the particular kind of topological invariant that turns out to be useful for electrons and solids. So the analogy, it turns out there's a similar kind of integral that's very easy to picture, which is just the Gauss-Bonnet formula. So if I take a two-dimensional surface, at any point, there are two radii of curvature. So I want to define one over the product of those radii, and I want to define a sign so that the sphere has positive curvature because both radii have the same sense. They're either both toward me or both away from me. And the equator of the hyperboloid, I define to have negative curvature. And this cylinder, although you might think it's curved, of course, has zero Gaussian curvature. Now, for closed surfaces, the magic happens when I integrate the Gaussian curvature over the area. If I take the sphere, for example, we know the surface area is 4 pi r squared. Gaussian curvature is 1 over r squared. So my integral gives me 4 pi. And the magic now is that that's not just independent of radius. It's independent of any continuous deformation. But if I took the torus and did the same curvature integral, well, the negative curvature on the inside would cancel out the positive curvature on the outside. I would get 0. So in our language, the integral of the curvature over the surface is quantized. It's this 2 pi times 2 minus 2 times the number of holes. So why do I go through this example? Well, we're going to do the same thing of integrating a curvature over a surface. We just need to define something like a curvature for electron wave functions. And if you're new to solids, there's only one fact you need to know, which is quite simple to show. If I take electrons in a periodic potential, and I am going to say a bit later about how to get around the assumption of periodicity and non-interactions, lack of interactions, because that's actually one of the reasons why the magnetoelectric stuff was important. So if I focus on single electrons in a periodic potential, I can write the wave functions as a product of a plane wave and a periodic part, where periodic means periodicity of the unit cell. Now the momentum that appears here we call crystal momentum. And it runs over the Brillouin zone, which is some region of k-space with periodic boundary conditions. And in this talk, that's just going to be the d-dimensional torus. So that will be the surface. We need to now define some kind of curvature that we can integrate over the Brillouin zone to get something interesting to happen. And the curvature we need is the so-called Berry phase. And if you remember your adiabatic theorem, there's one part of the story that amazingly doesn't seem to have been fully understood until the 80s. So if I take a non-degenerate state of a Hamiltonian and I smoothly change the Hamiltonian, if I do it slowly enough, we know that the system remains in that state. But it turns out there's something else that happens. If I take the Hamiltonian around a closed path, there's actually a measurable phase. So for us, the path and parameter space, well, we're just going to be interested in momentum. So I'll write that as k. And the phase I build up can be written as an integral of a vector potential. So in this case, with a single state, this is an abelian connection. It turns out that for topological insulators, the right object is something non-abelian, where the UN bundle is the N occupied bands in the Brillouin zone. But for now, let me just focus on the U1 case. So if I write this, you might wonder, well, to write this, I had to choose some reference function, some definition of the state at each point in k-space, and that has some ambiguity. It has a U1 ambiguity because we might choose different phases. If I do that, well, the nice thing about this is that it transforms just like what we're used to in E&M. So let me just restrict to smooth choices of phase. If I choose psi and you choose some different phase convention, then the vector potential just changes by a gradient. So that immediately tells you that A, at a particular point in the Brillouin zone, it cannot be physical if it depends on the choice of phase. But we know how to make possibly physical things from A. And a neat story of the last 30 years is that almost every natural geometrical object you can make out of this script A, the vector potential that measures how the wave functions are changing, has some physical consequence. And the first one to be understood was just curl of A, which I'll call Berry curvature. So what was pointed out by Thouless et al. Was the following. Let me think about a two-dimensional lattice system, and I'm going to assume that the magnetic flux is such that I can still define block states, commensurate flux. So if I can do that, then let me integrate F over the two-dimensional Brillouin zone. So this is just writing out what is F in terms of the periodic part of the block state. Now, just like in that geometric example, when I integrate this curvature, I get an integer. I get an integer for each band or each degenerate set of bands. And those integers are physical in that if I add them up, and this is what Thouless et al. Basically did through the Kubo formula, is show that the integer for a band is just how much does that band, if it's occupied, contribute to the quantum Hall effect. So that's the connection between topology and something measurable. It turns out that loop integrals of A give polarization, or actually the way that people compute polarization in real materials. And I'll talk more about the Chern-Simons form of A in a second. So just to, for the pedagogical part, let me answer a couple of questions you might have. So in order to, for this to be quantized, I should have all my bands be completely filled or completely empty. If I had a partially filled band, then there's not even really a universal number here. Or to be precise, the integral of F is meaningful but not quantized. It determines the anomalous Hall effect, or part of the anomalous Hall effect. But that's a very complicated story I don't want to get into. So if I'm talking about an insulator with every band either completely filled or completely empty, what's conducting the charge? So in most experiments, actually many experiments, let's say, the actual conduction is at the edge of the sample. So this doesn't have to be true. The Laughlin argument that I think you heard about yesterday is a counterexample. But most of the time, the transport's actually happening from the edge state. And then what the bulk integer tells me is really just how many perfect quantum wires do they have to be at the boundary. So this is that metallic edge. So I want to give a quick sketch of how that happens. But the sketch is not a very good argument. A better argument is the sort of anomaly argument that Andreas already told you about. The sketch of why bulk topology should have something to do with the edge is the following. If I take some wave functions that are topologically non-trivial in the bulk, and there's some topological invariant that counts that. So to actually draw the wave functions is too many dimensions, so I just drew a knot, which is a different kind of topology, but this is something topologically non-trivial. The wave functions outside are topologically trivial. So to get from inside to outside, I must violate my assumption and therefore not have all the bands completely filled or completely empty. Basically, my integers cannot suddenly jump from 1 to 0. So if I can go continuously like this, then I have a problem unless I'm metallic in between. So it's kind of a proof by contradiction. Now, the problem with the argument, the reason why the anomaly arguments or the Laughlin argument are better, is that this assumes some notion of smoothness so I could define topology. But we believe that the edge is there even for a very sharp boundary. And for the quantum Hall effect, there's no symmetry condition that I need to make the edge be there. It's really quite robust and universal. I could always add more. So nothing prevents me from adding an ordinary quantum wire running along the sample in both directions. But at a minimum, there's this quantum wire forced on us by the bulk. And I'll explain a bit about a field theory representation of that toward the end. So to connect that to what is the subject of this talk and things you might have heard about already, if I wanted a semi-classical picture of a quantum spin Hall edge, I could think about electrons making circles in the magnetic field that get interrupted by the sample boundary, so I get this skipping orbit. Where we're now going is to try and explain what kind of Berry phase topology underlies, first of all, the quantum spin Hall effect. So if I add, if I forget about the magnetic field but had L dot S coupling, spin orbit coupling, let me just focus on the Z component. Then if I fix the spin up, this is like a magnetic field. Well, it's a momentum dependent force, so it's like a magnetic field, and it's pointing one way for spin up, but the opposite way for spin down, and that's the quantum spin Hall edge. And then the 3D topological insulator, you can view sort of as rotating this middle picture, both the spin and K, around the vertical axis in the screen. So I get a two-dimensional metallic state where the spin is locked to the momentum. So these are just pictures. This doesn't explain why this should happen and why it should be protected. And that's where the insight was. So to give the history, now we jump ahead about 25 years to 2005. And what I'm going to focus on here is Berry phases and topological invariants. So what was done was finding new kinds of topological invariants that, first of all, depend on having time reversal, while the previous invariance required that I break time reversal. So to get a non-zero Chern number, I had to break P. The physical origin is different because they're coming from spin orbit, and a nice thing is that these work in 3D as well as 2D. So the quantum spin Hall effect, let me sketch this, and I think one of the foundational papers was by Murakami, Nagase, and Zhang, and then Kane and Mali sort of explain the stability of it, which is what I'm going to focus on. So if I think about L dot S, I get spin moving in both directions, spin up going one way, spin down going the other way. And the reason why stability was kind of a question is it looks like upspin, once I turn on real spin orbit coupling, which involves all components, might backscatter into downspin. And in general, one-dimensional systems with disorder are localizing, so I would lose the edge and there's nothing topological. So if I can show that there's some topological invariant, that will protect the edge mode. So that's what we're going to look for. And that's what Kane and Mali wrote down. So the idea is that there's a new kind of topological invariant which only takes two values, sort of odd or even. So the Chern number we talked about before took an integer number of values. You heard one picture of this from Charlie. I'm going to give a different picture connected to the Berry phase. But either way, the key is that there is some bulk recipe, something that we can compute without knowing about the details of the edge, that will tell us whether there's an edge there. So that's in the sense in which it's topological, or one sense. And then I'll briefly show the experiment. So let me, here's a just intuitive way to remember why there's an odd-even effect, and to base it on a very simple property of time reversal invariance. So for a spin half particle, if I have time reversal invariance, every eigenstate is degenerate with its time reversal conjugate and also different from its time reversal conjugate. While for even spin particles, bosons, there's no problem with the state being the same as its time reversal conjugate. But spin half particles like electrons always have these Cramer's pairs with time reversal invariance. And the stability of these pairs means that any time reversal invariant perturbation cannot mix the states in a pair. There can't be any matrix element, because if there were, I would split the pair. That would violate my theorem. So what that means is if I have a single Cramer's pair, like one right-moving mode and one left-moving mode, this is E versus K along the edge now, that are time reversal conjugate to each other, well, the lowest lying state carrying current to the right, so solid dot means occupied, empty circle means unoccupied, that can't backscatter to this, so there's no way to degrade this current, and it's actually protected. Now, the situation in a normal quantum wire, like a carbon nanotube or something, is that I've got both spin up and spin down moving right, both spin up and spin down moving left. And even though this process is still forbidden, nothing prevents me from scattering up to up or down to down. And that is indeed how quantum wires get localized. So if you like, by cutting the quantum wire in half, we've made it stable. And that same picture is what goes on in 3D as well. But note that to make this distinction, time reversal is really crucial. If I didn't have any time reversal, there's no distinction between ordinary and topological insulators. They're just insulators. In particular, they're continuously connected. And this picture, I think Charlie discussed, so just to explain the original picture from their paper, it was something like the following. If I think about a one-dimensional edge of a two-dimensional system, well, there are some special points in the Brillouin zone, like k equal to 0 and k equal to pi by a, where k is equivalent to minus k under time reversal. And that means that the Hamiltonian at those points is time reversal invariant. At points in the middle, like k equal to some arbitrary number, well, this is related by time reversal to some inequivalent point over here, so there doesn't have to be this twofold degeneracy. And their point was there are basically two ways to wire up Cramer's degenerate points at the two sides. One is that the two lines that come out of here go into the same point over there, which is ordinary insulator. But the interesting case is if the two lines that come out of here go into different points over there, then there's no way to stop this ladder, and I get edge modes at every energy. So that's the previous picture. And the reason why I mentioned this is we're going to do something like this in 3D in a second. But first, in 2D, there's a mathematical way to write down what is the Berry phase expression of the invariant. And this is something that Leon and I drew pictures for. The idea is basically the following. If I have time reversal invariance, the natural object is now half of the Brillouin zone, because k, if I know what's going on at k, that tells me what's going on at minus k. Now, the problem is half of the Brillouin zone, if you take a donut and chop it in half, you can now see the inside of the donut. In other words, it's a manifold with boundary. And that means that if I just integrate the curvature, which is now the curvature of at least two bands, so things are getting a bit more complicated, it's at least two bands because of this Cramer's degeneracy, I don't even get an integer. But what I can do is close my donut, I can put some caps on it, and this integral of A, which is over the boundaries of half the Brillouin zone, is basically just an integral of F over these caps. Now, just like in the Wessimino term, if I'm going to expand the space where my fields or Hamiltonians are defined, I need to know that that's always possible, and I need to know that I get a physically unique answer. So it's always possible. The uniqueness is not complete. Actually, only the parity is unique. So basically, F is gauge invariant. A, as I said, is not. But if you and I choose different gauges that sort of satisfy the right time reversal properties, we will only get numbers that differ by a multiple of 2. Whether we get odd or even is actually invariant. So that is going to be a type of Berry phase integral. I'll talk about another kind in a second, which is maybe more natural geometrically in 3D, but now back to the real world. This was the experiment I mentioned Mollenkamp earlier. So this is what the group did in Würzburg to see the quantum Hall effect. So it was argued that mercury cadmium telluride by the Stanford group would be a good material to look, and he is about the world's expert on quantum wells of that material. And what you see is the following. This is a two-dimensional quantum well in zero magnetic field, and you see a plateau in the conductance of 2E squared over H, which is the conductance of a quantum wire. Or in this case, it's what you would expect for half a quantum wire on each edge of the sample and no convection in the bulk. So this is a heroic experiment. It's 30 millikelvin. It's a tough sample to make, and it has been tough for other people to work on for that reason. Fortunately, the 3D effect, which I'm going to focus on in the rest of the talk, is much easier to do experiments on. So here is a sketch for why there is a 3D topological insulator, even though there's no 3D quantum Hall effect. Or to be precise, we can layer the quantum Hall effect, but there's no genuinely 3D version. So we, like many other people, were interested by this Kane-Mallee paper and started thinking about these Z2 invariants and what are different ways to understand them. So we, and then other people independently, realized that there was a 3D invariant. The way that works is the following. I want to argue that just like in 2D, there are some special points in the Brillouin zone, or actually special planes, where time reversal acts in a different way from a generic plane. Let me think about XY planes. So KZ equal to 0 is taken to itself by time reversal. So this is a two-dimensional plane with a time reversal invariance, which means I could classify it as ordinary or topological. Same thing is true for pi by A, because that gets taken to minus pi by A, which is the same thing by periodic boundary conditions. So that can be ordinary or topological. But the magic is, in between, I don't have time reversal, which means that in between, I can continuously interpolate from ordinary to topological or vice versa without closing the gap. Now, if instead, if I was talking about the quantum Hall effect, all these planes are the same, and if I've got a quantum Hall number up here, it's the same in all the planes. So basically, I've got one number for XY planes, one number for YZ planes, one number for XZ planes. While here, in addition to layering, I've got the possibility of changing. And the only hard work in what we did is the counting to make sure that if I, for example, do this trick of going from ordinary to topological in the Z direction, the same thing happens in the X and Y direction. So that's why there's a 3D topological insulator. And there should be some kind of metallic surface state. And what that surface should look like was pointed out by Fu, Kane, and Mallee. The nice thing is it's very much like what we saw in 2D, where the surface state is half of a normal metal. So what that means, it has an odd number of Dirac points. So this is now the metallic Fermi surface at the two-dimensional surface of a 3D material. It's got an odd number of Dirac points, which in the best materials is just one. And at every momentum, it has a single spin state rather than two. So one way to state this is that even including spin, it only has one sheet of the Fermi surface. With time reversal, that's normally impossible if you just have a two-dimensional material that's not the boundary of something. What we've basically done is take one sheet of the Fermi surface and put it at the top while the other sheet is at the bottom. So an easy way to remember the surface state, it's one quarter of graphene because graphene has two of these Dirac points and it also has two spin states. And what's nice is that some very old and well-studied materials turn out to be in this three-dimensional topological category. So this was seen by Zahid Hassan's group in ARPES. This is not the original experiment, and since he has already given a talk, I won't go into much detail. This is energy versus momentum. This is an old material, bismuth selenide, well known to have a band gap of about 0.3 eV. So all these states were not known to exist. They even look like a Dirac cone. They disperse like surface states. And if you measure the spin, you find that the spin here is opposite the spin there. So that's pretty good confirmation of the theory. The excitement from an experimental point of view, if you're used to quantum Hall physics, 1 Kelvin is a large energy scale. Here, the energy scale for the topological feature is 0.3 eV. So that's not large by semiconductor standards, but that's much more than 1,000 Kelvin. So all of a sudden, you don't need some fancy quantum well at millikelvin. You need a fairly ordinary crystal at reasonable temperature, at least if what you want to do is photo emission. So the other experiments are a bit harder. You need better crystals, I guess. So that's kind of the pedagogical part, or at least most of the pedagogical part, although the next few slides will still be from a year or two ago. But that's the story for the single electron picture of topological insulators. Something I didn't mention, but I think Andreas did, which is very beautiful, is that if you go back now and look at helium-3b, its quasi-particles are very much like the electrons of a topological insulator, and there should be a surface state. So far, one big hole in what I've done is I said that a topological phase is one where some measurable quantity is quantized by a topological invariant, but I haven't yet said what is that quantity for topological insulators. And another way to motivate that is when we want to define a phase, we don't want to define it in terms of single electron physics. We ought to be able to give an interacting picture. And then related to that is the question of if we wanted to give something like Ginzburg-Landau theory for symmetry breaking phases, which is topological field theory for topological phases, what is the field theory description of whatever topological order is in topological insulators? So axion electrodynamics just means a particular term. Well, it may mean something more to particle physicists, but as I understand it, it's this particular term in the electromagnetic Lagrangian, E dot B, which is a bit special because it's a total derivative of the Chern-Simons form of the vector potential A. So it's natural that this one would be associated with boundaries in a way that E cross B, for example, would not, or the rank 2 combination. Now, if I write the coefficient in this way with a dimensionless parameter theta, what's kind of amazing is that theta is odd under time reversal. Well, that's not amazing, but it's actually periodic. To be precise, the bulk contribution from a material to theta is only defined modulo 2 pi. In that respect, it's actually like the bulk contribution to polarization. Or only the fractional part is determined by the bulk, and I want to say a bit more about that. But if I believe in that periodicity, then there are actually two values, two inequivalent values compatible with time reversal. Theta equal to 0 is certainly allowed, or more generally, 2 pi n is allowed. But if I think about the odd multiples of pi, like, for example, pi gets taken to minus pi under time reversal, but minus pi is equivalent to pi under the periodicity. And we believe that topological insulators are theta equal to pi materials, and I want to explain how that was figured out and how it connects to what I said before about topological insulators, something with an odd number of Dirac fermions.
So where does the periodicity come from?
The periodicity comes from the following. If I don't modify the bulk, but I'm allowed to make an arbitrary surface without modifying the bulk, I could slap on integer quantum Hall layers that are localized at the boundary. So let me give and those integer quantum Hall layers, so that's basically changing n here. If I ask about what gives rise to this, well, I said it was surface Chern-Simons of A, which is just a surface quantum Hall effect. So to say that there's an E dot B term is equivalent to saying there's a surface quantum Hall effect. So it's the freedom to add integer quantum Hall layers at the boundary. The analog of that is with polarization, if I don't modify the bulk of a crystal, I can add an integer number of charges per unit cell if I want to keep the crystal structure. So the normal wisdom is that polarization as measured, which is surface charge density, is ambiguous modulo one charge per unit cell. But the fractional part can only come from the bulk, and the same thing is true here. So at least the condensed matter picture of periodicity of theta doesn't have anything really to do with non-abelian gauge fields, except when I talk about the Berry phase in a second. but it does have to do with the ambiguity of what exactly is my surface. Now, if you might wonder, what if I tried to put on a fractional quantum Hall surface or something? Well, under the toroidal conditions where you'd actually measure that, that would have degeneracies. So if I put on a non-degenerate local surface, we think that has to be an integer. So the people who made the connection between this and topological insulators were Chi, Hughes, and Zhang. And the connection to the surface quantum Hall effect is pretty easy to draw. If I ask what would measure this E dot B term, it's just the magnetoelectric effect. Apply an electric field and get a magnetic moment parallel to it, and vice versa. So if I have surface quantum Hall layers, and in particular, this is measurable under conditions where the surface is gapped. So this is kind of an orthogonal definition to the one before. The one before was that I've got gapless odd number of Dirac fermions. Now I'm assuming that I can add some local perturbation at the boundary, like magnetic impurities, that will gap the boundary without modifying the bulk. And if I do that, then I'll find that I have actually half-integer quantum Hall effect from each boundary. Half-integer quantum Hall effect is the statement that theta is an odd multiple of pi. And the connection, the reason why you might believe that, goes back to graphene. So one of the smoking guns that graphene was actually Dirac fermions and contributed, I'm sure, to its getting the Nobel Prize, was measuring the quantum Hall effect, just integer quantum Hall effect, but seeing unusual integers. So for a normal two-dimensional electron gas, we would see 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 times e squared over h. Now we see like minus 10, minus 6, minus 2, 2, 6, 10. And those numbers are exactly 4 times a half integer. So if you remember my argument before that graphene is 4 Dirac fermions, that indeed shows that one Dirac fermion should give me a half integer. So if I have one Dirac fermion at the boundary, and I can manage to gap it, I should get a theta equal to pi magnetoelectric effect. So the other thing that they did, which we had a slightly different derivation of, and I'll talk about some puzzles in a second that we came across that had an interesting answer. The E dot B term, which I could measure as dm by dE or dp by dB, assuming I can gap the surfaces, the way that's computed microscopically is kind of neat. So I told you before that every natural geometric object we can make out of the Berry phase seems to be telling us something. The Chern-Simons form, which is this combination of ABA, and now this is non-abelian Chern-Simons form of the UN bundle of all the bands. So script A is what the electrons are doing. That's the electron Berry phase, while unscript is the electromagnetic field. This you would call the second Chern form of the electromagnetic field is coming from the Chern-Simons form of what the electrons are doing. And for those of you who have done UN Chern-Simons terms in particle physics, you'll know an interesting fact, which is that this is not quite gauge invariant. It has large gauge transformations. So I can make a transformation that is not homotopic to the null transformation, which shifts this by 2 pi in the right units. So that's kind of the mathematical implementation of this 2 pi periodicity. But again, if I'm only given the bulk wave functions, I can't tell you theta, but I can tell you if it's an even or odd multiple of pi. This, I wanted to sketch a bit why this was important and worth thinking about in more detail. Everyone always, to give pedagogical talks, starts with band structure, but it's not necessary, although it's slightly more tricky to generalize from band structure than it was in the quantum Hall effect. So in the quantum Hall effect, Thouless, in that original paper I mentioned, was thinking about single electrons in crystals. But a few years later, and I think they were not the only people thinking along these lines, so I'll just mention them, what they showed was that there's a different way to think about the same mathematical object. So the mathematical object was, how does a wave function evolve with two parameters, which are kx and ky? Now I want to think about some big hunk of material, which has disorder and interactions and whatever. It's just a black box, except that it remains insulating. So if I can if that black box has the topology of a torus, well, I can put fluxes through the two great circles of the torus, and now what I think about is the wave function as a function of those two fluxes. So those are my two parameters, instead of kx and ky. Now, for a band structure, this is exactly equivalent to what I did before, because if you want to think about what is k in a band structure problem, it's really like it determines a phase that I pick up when I go from one unit cell to the next. So anyway, integrating over these phases, I now take the many-body wave function. So I've got some non-degenerate ground state and its derivatives with respect to these fluxes, and I can just reinterpret the Chern number. So exactly the same mathematics solves the problem with interactions in disorder. For Z2 invariants, this flux trick does solve the disorder problem, but it doesn't solve the interacting problem, I claim. And that's for the following reason. The many-body ground state is one wave function, but what I used to write down the Chern-Simons integral a moment ago, this actually has to be a non-abelian bundle for this to work. It has to be some set, which I can take to be flattened, of the occupied states. So I cannot replace un by u1 and use that Chern-Simons integral. So what we need is some way to evaluate whether I've got an ordinary or topological insulator with interactions using an integral that remains well-defined if I've only got the many-body ground state. And that, it turns out, not to be putting fluxes through the circles of the torus, but you put flux through the unit cell itself. And this is something that probably people working on polarization could have realized a while ago, because I mentioned that polar... Sorry, what was that?
For clarification. I can imagine that I kind of use very fancy, more U1-ish gauge fields right on the torus instead of U1. That's going to do the fact that I've now more degrees of freedom, like spin and so forth. So why is it obstructed? Why doesn't that exist?
Well, the way to think, if I could find a way to pull out, the problem is I'm just given the many-body ground state. That I don't know any way to pull out all that information. There is a construction along those lines by Sung-Sik Lee and Shin-Sei Ryu. It's a little bit more complicated than what I'm going to do, and I guess I want to restrict myself to the statement is if I just have the many-body ground state wave function, I can't directly plug that into the Chern-Simons integral the way that I could in the integer quantum Hall case. So I don't want to say that it absolutely can't be done.
Perhaps my question is more naive, right? When you have just normal quantum Hall, you just know that you have that U1 associated with electromagnetism, but now you can imagine that you make up some fanciful external flux, right? That's really talking to all this spin-orbit coupling business. Right? And then I can imagine that I can use these UN fields of effort, I don't know what that is.
People have done that sort of thing. I don't know that it's been used for this purpose, but people have definitely thought about if I put in a fictitious non-abelian gauge field that is coupling to the full UN bundle, what would that do?
I think that kind of your work shows that it works for Holmes being hard. The boundary condition, some strange, because it's two boundary conditions.
But that was in the non-interacting case. So for interacting case, actually I've never done anything in 2 plus 1, but in 3 plus 1 it's fairly elegant. But people have thought about some effective non-abelian gauge field, they've done various things with it, but I don't think they've checked this ordinary versus. Actually, what has been done that is somewhat similar, if I look at the Green's function, so I've got a many-body Green's function of the electron, which in principle has a lot of information in it about the structure, can you write an invariant a bit like what Volovic did for the quantum Hall effect just in terms of the Green function? So I think Victor Garari will probably talk about that in a week or two. It's challenging. There are some subtleties with topological insulators in particular, but the advantage of that is that that's what we think of as more like a ground state quantity or maybe a more natural numerical quantity than what I'm going to talk about, which is a response. But the statement is, let me now get back to where I was. If I can compute dp by dB, and to be precise, I want to take a box of the bulk, and I want to apply essentially the minimum magnetic field I can and keep periodic boundary conditions, which is one flux quantum through the box, then there are actually two ways in which the polarization can change. It can change by something like zero, or to be precise, something that's equivalent to zero by the polarization quantum, which is E by transverse area, or it can change by something that's equivalent to half of this. So the way to state this, and here the point of this little argument is both polarization and magnetic field have a quantum that's non-universal and depends on a geometrical factor, but those actually cancel out. So dp by dB is a very universal quantity with units of E squared over H. And so this is actually, I think, what's quantized in a topological insulator is the magnetoelectric effect. And in particular, that's a bulk quantity that you compute with interactions if you know how the state changes when I put a flux through it. So it's no longer through the circles of the torus, it's actually through the material itself. So that means that there is something quantized, but it's not a new number. It's still e squared over h. And as I mentioned, it is intimately connected, as pointed out by Chi, Hughes, and Zhang, to what's going on at the surface. So I mentioned that we were puzzled by something, which is we had a derivation of their formula that seemed to give a bunch of extra terms. But for topological insulators, it was pretty clear that they had to be right, and those extra terms couldn't be there. So here's what those extra terms mean. If you think about the magnetoelectric effect in general, so E cross B, et cetera, all the things that have been measured for lots of years, especially in materials that are so-called multiferric, basically materials that break inversion and break time reversal, can have any value of E dot B. They can also have E cross B and so on. So I've got some tensor in general, and it's got lots of parts. But even the scalar diagonal part doesn't seem always to be given by that Chern-Simons formula. That was what puzzled us. But it is, as it almost has to be, for topological insulators. So the full answer is the following. So this is the magnetoelectric effect in general, and it's got two parts. So this is now for multiferoids, for everything. This is no assumption about symmetry. The first part is what you'd expect from ordinary quantum mechanical perturbation theory. There are some tricks in how you evaluate this in a crystal, and the tricks basically consist in putting a slash through the R and figuring out what that means. But this is basically a correlation function of electric dipole moment and magnetic dipole moment. And there's an energy denominator between occupied states and empty states, just like you'd expect. But there's always this topological or Chern-Simons part as well. So this is a pure Berry phase. There are no energy denominators. It's just a matter of how the wave functions are changing. So what happens with topological insulators is that symmetry forces the ordinary part to be zero and quantizes the topological part to just one of two possibilities. But every multiferroic turns out to have this Chern-Simons contribution. So there's something fairly geometrical about the magnetoelectric effect everywhere. Which, given that that has been a long-standing problem, how do you compute orbital magnetoelectricity? I think it's kind of neat that part of the answer is this part that came from topological insulators. So what I want to do now in the last 15 minutes or so...
What symmetry is eliminating the second line there?
If I have either time reversal or inversion, that will eliminate the second line. Basically, think of it as like it's something that's linear in E and linear in B. So naively, unless there's some weird topological thing, you would think that it has to be inversion odd and time reversal odd, because E is inversion odd and time reversal even, and B is the opposite. And the way that works, this, like if I ask about these parts, are basically fixing up some little things, but this part is again time reversal odd and inversion odd, that correlator.
One could have a topological insulator which is has no inversion symmetries whatsoever.
Right.
And then that term would be non-zero, is that?
No, either inversion or time reversal. Right. So, but what this suggests and what is true is that there's something that are, if I had inversion but not time reversal, this would actually still be quantized. Or, in fact, I can have an antiferromagnet that has the following symmetry. If I pick it up and move it over half a unit cell and then flip time reversal, then it, strictly speaking, doesn't have to have either time reversal inversion, but it will still have symmetry there. So sometimes people use the term axionic insulator for something that has only the quantized response, but for reasons other than time reversal symmetry. So theta equal to pi is quite special, but the geometric part is kind of always there. And David Vanderbilt is someone who has worked on actually computing this in real materials.
So I said earlier on, when you consider these sort of meat and potato built for Warwick, right? Multi-insulating things, and they have a spin spiral, a spin orbit coupling, and all that you get electrical dipole. These things also have a topological contribution, or is it?
Yes, although that's a very good condensed matter question, and I took out some of my condensed matter specific slides because I didn't think people would ask such good questions.
Okay.
Yes. So this is a boring multiferroic. This is bismuth iron ferrite. Bismuth iron oxide. And the point is that in general, there are actually four kinds of contributions to the magnetoelectric effect. Some of them have to do with the spin. So, for example, you can ask where does the magnetic moment come from and where does the polarization come from? So the magnetic moment could come from the spin, what we talked about so far is only the orbital part, and the polarization could come from the electrons or from moving the ions. So the part that is the hardest to compute historically is this one, which is what we claim to have computed. In many materials, it's dominated by these others. Yeah. The thing about this, which is actually kind of nice, is that a practical problem with multiferrets is, in general, if you're moving ions around, you're degrading the material. This part is, and it's also slow. So this is kind of the fast, non-degrading part, although it's not always the largest part. But that since it's not actually clear that multiferrets are too useful in applications, as far as I know, they haven't been commercialized. That's more of an advantage in principle at this point. What I like about it is just, it's, I think, the most interesting part of the response. But for example, the kind of calculation that David has been doing is just take a real material, like Cr203, which is the one material I know where theta has actually been measured, and it's measurable but not tiny, and work out how much of that pi by 24 is coming from these different mechanisms. And he says about 10% is the one that we like. I'm not going to show all 150 slides, I promise. So don't get worried. Right, so now I think someone who definitely popularized the term topological order and gave a deeper picture of what it is Xiaogang Wen. He explained that some topological phases, at least, we can define by topological field theories, and that's the right description for universal aspects in the way that Ginzburg-Landau is the right description for symmetry-breaking phases. So what is the right universal description of topological insulators? Well, let me remind you of a success, which is the quantum Hall effect. So what we're going to try to do is come up with something for topological insulators. We wanted to capture some of the essential kind of macroscopic responses in the same way that Chern-Simons does that for quantum Hall effect. And in particular, I want to focus on describing the surface fermion, because that's pretty tricky. And then finally, a nice thing about this is that even though we don't yet have fractional topological insulators, we can write what should be an effective theory for them, at least one possible effective theory. And maybe that will give some guidance. So here's the history. Okay, forget this Landau-Ginzburg, that's incorrect. It should just be Chern-Simons. So we believe that the quantum Hall effect is described by this kind of effective Lagrangian, where A, this little a, is not the electromagnetic gauge field. It's a U1 internal gauge field. It's basically describing what the electrons are doing. So as an example of one thing we can get out of this, if I couple this to E and M, which is big A, and now integrate out little a, then I get a Chern-Simons term for big A, except that k here has gone to 1 over k there. So for example, if I took k equal to 1, this is actually the electromagnetic description of integer quantum Hall effect at nu equal to 1. If I took k equal to 3 here, I would get 1/3 there, so that's the Laughlin state. But now putting k equal to 3 here has some nice effects. It basically means that I get fractional statistics between quasi-particles. One point I want to make, which is a little bit confusing, in the quantum Hall effect, the Lagrangian, what I would call the internal theory, is form equivalent to the electromagnetic term. But this I would call topological field theory. This I would call some topological-ish term that I just add to the Maxwell term. But they both look the same. I'm going to claim that for topological insulators, the story is a little bit richer, and they're actually not the same thing. But what good is this as far as something I can measure? Well, if I took this, I realize a difference between this Chern-Simons term and the Maxwell term. So the Maxwell term is totally gauge invariant. This is gauge invariant, where gauge invariance means just A goes to A plus grad chi, only up to a boundary. So if I put this on a manifold with boundary, there's no problem. Sorry, manifold without boundary, like a torus, there's no problem. But if I put this on a disk, something interesting happens, which is that basically you can view it as something has to be at the boundary in order for the whole theory to be gauge invariant. There has to be some additional degree of freedom. And it's very easy to turn the crank and work out that that additional degree of freedom is a chiral boson. You can sort of understand this as part of the gauge transformation that was there. So what Wen explained is that a way you might be able to measure the bulk topological order is that the gapless surface depends on what was happening in the bulk, and in particular, it has two parts. There's a first order in time part, which means zero Hamiltonian, but that's okay because it's coming from a topological field theory where all the energies are zero anyway. And then there's another part, which is just a velocity term that I assume is coming from some non-universal edge physics. But the universal part is measurable in things like tunneling exponents into the edge. So a spectacular prediction of Wen's theory is that if I measure tunneling into the edge of the Laughlin state, well, into the edge of the integer quantum Hall state, I'll see current linear in voltage, which is very natural, Ohm's law. If I measure tunneling in the Laughlin state, I'll see current going as voltage cubed. Experimentally, it's strongly non-ohmic. It's maybe V to the 2.7 or something, but the problem is it doesn't really have the right plateau structure. But at least the prediction that tunneling into fractional quantum Hall edges should be strikingly non-ohmic is correct. So what can we do like that for topological insulators? So I'm going to claim that there's a certain kind of BF theory. And in 2D, this is very simple. In 3D, it's a bit more complicated, that this is the right effective description of topological insulators. So this is the 3D version. So it now involves two gauge fields. One is one form, one is a two form. And again, there is a topological term coupling them. So this is in 3 plus 1. In 2D, B would just be a vector as well. This topological term is, again, not totally gauge invariant, so there ought to be something at the boundary. Then there are various ways to couple this to E and M. So what I want to try and sketch, if I can have 10 more minutes, is what are some of the things that come out of this theory that make we think that make us think it's right? And this is work with Guillaume Cho, as I mentioned. So the reason why this BF theory in 3 plus 1 is kind of exciting, in 2 plus 1, if you ask about bulk properties, maybe the most exciting thing that comes out of Chern-Simons is fractional statistics of particles. In 3 plus 1, we believe that there are no fractional statistics of point-like particles in 3 plus 1, but you can have fractional statistics of points and lines, and that's what's described by BF theory. Basically, the line-like source of the B field and the point-like source of the A field can have fractional statistics.
Joe, there was this coefficient C here that describes the coupling to an external gauge field.
Yes.
Is that fixed, or is that?
It does get fixed in a moment. So basically, this one is kind of the surface term, and it can be fixed by the half-integer quantum Hall effect that we kind of know. So it's not a free parameter in the end.
You get a very basic question, Joel. So these two-form fields are also U1, right? So all fields here are U1.
It's all abelian, that's right.
Yeah. Now, you could think that the sort of fundamental topology of the electrons is all the time encoded in these UN bundles. Right? So what's the reason to saying that the topological field theory only knows about some U1 substructure or substructure to the principal maturation?
Yeah, I think...
Basically the same question as I asked before.
Yeah, well, I think in 2D, it's very familiar what this theory is doing, and it captures... so. I'll write down the 2D version in a second, but basically what it's going to describe in 2D is two copies of integer quantum Hall effect in opposite directions, which is the original picture of the quantum spin Hall effect. So maybe there's something non-abelian in the quantum spin Hall effect that's not captured by that, but it's hard for me to think of what it is. I think all the basic properties of the quantum spin Hall effect you can understand through two things. It's paired integer quantum Hall states, and then the one thing that misses is the Z2-ness. So if you can understand the integer quantum Hall stuff in the Z2-ness, I'd say that's successful in 2D, and that doesn't require anything fancy or non-abelian. So, and then the magic is somehow that if you go from 2 plus 1 dBF to 3 plus 1 dBF, you get a theory that has some very nice properties, although it's fair to say we don't understand it as well as we do 2 plus 1 dBF for Chern-Simons.
And related to Yan's question, so there are fractional 2D quantum spin Hall states, which will just take layers of fractional quantum Hall. So then I can, so for that theory, we will have a non-abelian double the Chern-Simons theory. But is that still equivalent to some BF theory?
I don't know much about non-abelian BF theories because they didn't come up in what we had to do. But I would say that it's, okay, probably the right way to think of a theory like that is paired Chern-Simons. There's a subtle difference between paired Chern-Simons and what you might call proper BF, which is the quantization lattice. But I guess at least paired abelian states are described by abelian BF theory. Paired non-abelian states in different layers, I mean, I think you could write something that would be a paired non-abelian Chern-Simons and say that describes it, and what you call it, whether you call it non-abelian BF or not, is up to you.
Yeah, another thing is, I guess it's sort of orthogonal to this UM question. So we learned from Andreas yesterday that in principle you can also worry about geometric gravitational parallel transport.
Yeah.
Right? I like to think that when you go to the works of Richard Vollefegg in Healing 3B, and this is neat stories about that you need can mimic the sort of gravitational topological effect. And perhaps that needs a very different type of turn silence. How is that?
Well, there are different, so that's again the difference maybe between internal and external fields. Like all the responses that Andreas was talking about are generalizations of this kind of thing, including to gravity and so on. But yeah, it could be true that, but as a simple example, I mean, I don't know, yeah. No, something that I think is an important open problem would be for the superfluid classes, which are the ones that would have the gravitational response, what is the version of this theory? Actually, Hansen has a recent paper on for P plus IP superconductor, which would be the first case. Is there a version of BF theory with Majoranas that would describe P plus IP? And then for gravity, the natural one would be helium 3, B phase, and 3D. Is there a generalization of what we did that would include sort of the Majorana and gravitational aspects? No, it's a good question, but that's ahead of where we are at the moment.
So in the case of the kind of really insulator topological phases, in general, you don't have to worry about the gravitational sinks. You know it's sort of an internal case.
Well, there we have a U1. I mean, yeah, so we might as well worry about the U1, but it might be true. And these are good advanced questions, but let me get through some of the basics before we get to, let us walk before we run.
Can I just clarify something? Is B a gauge field? Is it a two-form gauge field, or it's just a...
B is a two-form field with the gauge invariance. So it's an anti-symmetric. it's just like A. But yeah, first let me do the, so in 2 plus 1, what this is doing is basically the following. It's just forming even and odd combinations of the spin up and spin down fields to get a Lagrangian that looks like this. Now let me explain. So this has some things that are right. It has two oppositely propagating modes at the boundary. If I don't break time reversal at the boundary, and it also gets some of the other things right. Like if I put in the coupling to E and M, it's known that a nice way to tell apart a topological insulator from an ordinary insulator in 2D is that if I stick in a pi flux in the topological insulator, it traps some low-lying doublet of modes, which it doesn't do in an ordinary insulator. And that's captured by this. So the problems that you might think about are, well, the whole lesson of that Kane and Malik paper was that we shouldn't really think about spin as a conserved quantity, but here it looks like a conserved quantity. The right way to do this would be, this has, another way to put it, this has two U1 currents. I should add all the terms that break U1 down to Z2. In a scaling sense, those are irrelevant, both in the bulk and at the edge. But there may be processes where even though they're irrelevant, they're dominant. So for example, two-particle backscattering is something that is irrelevant but will dominate some experiments. If it becomes relevant, then it will actually put me into a different phase because it spontaneously breaks time reversal. So even though the theory, as I've written it, looks like it has two U1s, if you like, I should write plus various irrelevant terms in the scaling sense that break U1 down to Z2. Now, for the other small subtlety is, this theory has been studied in various other situations in condensed matter. In particular, there's a very nice paper by Hansen, Oganessian, and Sondi. They were thinking about spin liquids and superconductors. And I don't have much to say about superconductors, but for spin liquids, they were using BF theory to sort of formalize the relationship, well, the sort of Z2 effect of a bison in the Z2 spin liquid language. The difference between that and this comes into whether the compactness condition is imposed on A and B or on A up and A down. It turns out that affects things like the ground state degeneracy and so on. So that's kind of a technical detail that I won't get into, but it seems like the same Lagrangian describes several different problems, but the full theory is not just the Lagrangian, it's the Lagrangian plus the quantization conditions plus irrelevant terms.
All right. Another question. So you really will use transamine theory to describe the gravitational quantum hall.
I mean, the integer quantum hall.
But for integer quantum hall, so there basically is no excitation, right? I mean,
there's an edge. No, this is something, this is perhaps a philosophical thing that I've always, people will say that and I'm always troubled by it. So my own opinion is that if I ask you, how do you describe whatever order there is in the integer quantum Hall effect, I think it's integer valued Shrink-Simons theory. That gives you the edge, it gives you other properties, and so on. It's true there's no ground state degeneracy. There's no fractional statistics either. But there is something there that is captured by integer Shrink-Simons theory. So I guess I don't agree with your prelude, which is the statement that Shrink-Simons is only for the fractional case. I would say, I don't know what else there is for the integer case. I think it's the right description for the integer case, too.
So I should interpret the gauge field as still as dual of the current, like in the fractional case?
I think it couples in the same way. The only difference is in K. Yeah.
K
equals 1.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's just K equal to 1. So to me, like, what we would what could have happened with the quantum Hall effect but didn't was that they did the experiment. Someone wrote down this theory of K equal to 1, and then someone said, aha, you can write down K equal to 3, and then Laughlin found his wave function. So that sounds silly, but that's actually what happened with superconductivity, basically, that people had the effective theory before the microscopic theory. So we're hoping that could happen with fractional topological insulators, because at the moment, as you'll hear next week, you'll hear about another kind of effective theory. We have more effective theories than we have microscopic Hamiltonians. Okay, but getting back to... this is what I mentioned about the two things that are a bit subtler, this compactness condition and the addition of irrelevant terms. But 2D in general is pretty simple, and I don't think we would have bothered to write a paper on 2D. 3D is kind of the excitement. This is a bit about the relation to Z2 spin liquids, which I think for this audience I will skip over. So for 3D, let me explain what we can do. So two things that we can do are, first of all, put in the couplings to electromagnetism, use various things that we know to figure out the one free coefficient. So these are the couplings that are allowed by the requirement that they be topological and time reversal invariant. This one is coming from time reversal breaking at the surface, so it's not time reversal invariant. Then I get an electromagnetic current that looks like this. So it gets contributions from both parts, and if you want, this would be something like a particle current related to the surface. It's a total derivative. And this would be something like you can view B as like a magnetization and polarization tensor. So its divergences give me contributions to the current.
The thing that communicates with the electromagnetic current is the one-form field and mu. Right? So the two-form field can be sourced by strings.
That's right, but the two-form...
What would be the string?
But it still contributes, you could think of them as electro... the source... What I can say is if I put in an electromagnetic flux tube, I can get the configurations of the A and B fields that come out. I guess my intuitive picture of them is that the source for B is like a tensor that has the electric polarization and the magnetic polarization. So in fact, I think I have, this is a...
So now a Maxwell term has the same dimension and number of derivatives as the last term.
We could include it. It doesn't change the things I'll talk about, but you're right that should be included. It's not like 2 plus 1D where it's dominated by Shrink-Simons, but it doesn't modify the essential physics.
Sorry, where does it say that in the action? Now a J definition with a
theta. Yes, so that came from trying to fix this by the requirement that it generate the theta angle theta. So we place C by some theta times a number.
Okay.
Putting this in, integrating out little a and little b to get the electromagnetic term, E dot B, tells me that there's a relationship between C and theta. And again, C is kind of like a boundary term. It is a total derivative, and it produces this term, which is like a total derivative. So the thing I think I'd better focus on, because to me it was the most surprising, as I mentioned, that something that I think of as a success of Shrink-Simons theory is that it predicts an edge. So now we have a tougher challenge. We have to predict a surface. So it should be that if I did not break time reversal at the boundary, so if I forget about that term, and I could even just think about neutral particles, so forget about this term as well. The question is, if I just took this pure BF Lagrangian, which is not totally gauge invariant, under some symmetry conditions like time reversal, is there a surface state, and what does it look like? So I mentioned that I like this Hansen et al. Paper. So they pointed out that there are some bosons at the surface. In particular, there's a scalar boson and a vector boson. You can use the gauge degree of freedom to sort of make the boson, the vector, purely transverse. And it turns out that that combination, it was kind of known in the 80s, but probably forgotten, that if you have that combination of bosons, that's exactly what you need to faithfully represent a 2 plus 1 dimensional massless Dirac fermion. So let me explain how that works. I'm going to write up some algebra and then explain the algebra a bit in the next slide. But the caveats are that what this is saying is that if I have time reversal symmetry, there's a surface state. That surface state has the right degrees of freedom to produce a fermion. But I know that there are going to be additional surface terms that will determine the chemical potential for the fermions. In particular, whether it's at the Dirac point or not is a non-universal property. There will be fermionic interactions that I don't know how to handle. This bosonization is basically a property of the free theory, but the math is somewhat neat. So there's something called the tomographic representation, which is what I'll sketch in the next slide. But basically, I want to represent fields instead of, I'm going to go from Cartesian space for the bosons that come from BF theory to this tomographic representation, which is basically a ray perpendicular to n and a distance y from the origin. So this is the fermion I'm going to construct, and it comes from two bosonic fields, which are the two bosons that were forced on me by the bulk's lack of gauge invariance. So to get Fermi statistics, I'm going to need something like a Klein factor. This is basically the Klein factor. It's an integral of all the rays from 0 up to theta, and this Klein factor trick we found in a paper by Aretine. It's not original to us, but here is this tomographic representation and how it works. The thing which is a bit tricky is a modified version of the delta function. It's like half a derivative of the delta function. In 3 plus 1d, it would be the full derivative of the delta function. Turns out that if I define a quantity in this way and use that to transform my scalar field, my vector field, and my Dirac spinner between ordinary coordinates and this tomographic representation, I get a nice orthogonality condition as a result of having modified the delta function, which basically means I can get, to start with, bosons that and fermions that commute on different rays, but anti-commute for the fermions on the same ray. So it's sort of like I can bosonize each ray independently in the free case. There are no n derivatives and no couplings of different n. Once I turn on interactions and even chemical potential, that ceases to be true. I get couplings between different n, and it's not really clear how useful the formalism is. But in a sense, that doesn't matter, because if what we want to show is that there's a surface state that comes out of bulk BF theory, I'm not claiming this is a good way to calculate various fermionic effects at the boundary, but it's a way to see why there's a fermionic boundary. So if you like, this is leading into one of the big common puzzles between the two workshops we're having at the moment, which is how do you make non-Fermi liquids? So one is you put them at the boundary of gravity. Another is you put them at the boundary of a three-dimensional topological phase. Or to be precise, we know how to make non-Fermi liquids in 1 plus 1D. We really don't have nearly as good an understanding in 2 plus 1 or 3 plus 1, but it looks like the surface of BF theory, at least in the free case, is something interesting. And now we can go back, if we like, and just change K. So I didn't write out K, but there's no problem in principle in making a fractional BF theory. It will now become something that is an assembly of fractional Luttinger liquids. There are various things about that surface that are a bit unusual. It's certainly non-Fermi liquid. And what's tricky is we can't say as much about the stability as we can in 1 plus 1D, but it seems like a nice way to make a, and I think this is actually a general feature of constructions of 3D fractional topological insulators. I think one of the nicest things we should hope to get out of fractional 3 plus 1D topological insulators is non-Fermi liquids in 2 plus 1. So I think a good question for any construction is, yes, what is the boundary, and is there any way to make sure that it's different from the ordinary metal? Here, we understand the integer case. The fractional case, one can compute things, but it's not clear how robust they are. So that's kind of where we are at the moment.
So what do you get for the correlation function for fermions in case of
There's a subtraction that we don't know how to do. So basically, we get correlation functions that can be tuned to agree with the free fermion, but there is a degree of fine-tuning there, and it's not clear what protects it. So I guess I'd say that this gives me the Fermi liquid, the free fermion, or essentially the Fermi liquid, but it gives other things as well, and it's not clear what picks out the Fermi liquid rather than the other things.
So it's not as simple as getting some power law which depends on K or something like that.
One gets a power law that depends on the Luttinger parameter in each ray. So to motivate that, if I just thought about the one-dimensional edge of the topological insulator, so a nice thing about Wendt's theory for chiral states, if all the modes are moving in the same direction, then the scaling dimensions are independent of the interactions. When I've got modes moving in both directions like the topological insulator, then correlation functions now depend on an interaction. So here, we can choose that interaction on each ray to have one particular strength that would reproduce fermions, but why that strength? Why not some other strength? So I would say that the robustness, if there is a robustness of the free correlators, as we definitely expect when there's a chemical potential, it's less clear if there's not a chemical potential, then that robustness is a hard thing to see in this. But I suspect that in general, one should take this at most as saying that the bulk gives you the degrees of freedom you need to have a Dirac fermion at the boundary. And all it can give you is zero energy stuff. So all it can give you is a kinetic term. It can't give you anything about interactions or whatever. So there are limitations to what you can get from the bulk.
So but it happens. A2 and B2 are not already contained in the bulk theory. It's something you add.
No, they're forced by the bulk theory, by the lack of gauge invariants. So it's just like the. In 2 plus 1D, I get one scalar boson. Here, I get one scalar and one vector. Basically, if you like, the scalar comes from little a and the vector comes from little b, if I remember.
Does something like a current correlation function match Dirac fermions?
Again, that's this fine tuning question. So, nothing, as far as we know, uniquely determines what is the interaction between the left movers and right movers on one ray. And unlike the chiral case, things are sensitive to that.
The current doesn't get affected by
that's right. That one should be more robust. I'm not actually sure in this case because of the coupling between different rays. I'm still not sure that it's robust in this case. I should check.
So I'm wondering
I have one more slide, which is conclusions, and how about if we use this? Yes, conclusions. Good. Then we can have lots of questions. So the conclusions are. Well, I tried to give another pedagogical introduction to topological insulators from the point of view of Berry phase. And one nice thing about the Berry phase is that it gives you a nice microscopic way to understand the orbital electron part of magnetoelectric coupling in all materials. Topological insulators are a very nice case. And then finally, what seems to be a general theme, for example, if you look at recent work of Wen and collaborators, somehow, if you look at topological states that are protected by some kind of symmetry, there are very many possibilities out there. The quantum Hall effect is nice in that it doesn't have any symmetry and things are totally robust, while here, the requirements on a topological field theory are very severe because it has to be able to describe both the gap surface, which is this picture, and the gapless surface, which is that picture. And then finally, an open question, which I'm hoping to resolve in the next week or two, but that may be too optimistic. There are other kinds of fractional 3D topological insulators, in particular through the parton construction that you'll hear about from Joseph next week. The challenge is, it seems like the different constructions naturally do different things. Like here, if I make K fractional in the bulk, if I make K greater than 1 in the bulk, I get this fractional point line statistics. That's kind of the smoking gun. While with partons, I get other things, but the statistics are not as clear. So I don't yet even know if these are the same theory or not, but maybe other people will have comments on that. Anyway, so that's what I wanted to tell you about today. Thank you.
Yeah, I was just wondering about your previous slide. Is this the only possible construction that allows you to recover gauge invariance in the theory? So the one that you wrote down, or in principle, there are many other possibilities. So if I understood you correctly, so you wrote some term, and then you required gauge invariance, and this led to some sort of boundary.
I think that there are various other terms we write down. There, some of them we thought about, and they don't matter. Like the Maxwell term. Others are forbidden by the time reversal symmetry of the bulk. So I think that this is all the terms that are required to get the universal physics and that other things won't change it. But is that your question? Maybe.
Not real, but maybe I will ask you later.
So there has to be some anomaly of the boundary, right? In order to restore the gauge invariance. So what is that anomaly in terms of just 2 plus 1 dimensional Dirac fermions?
I don't know if it's, I mean, the same, let me see, dessert. So in 1 plus 1D, in the anomaly derivation of it, it's the either the chiral anomaly from just U1 electromagnetism. So, but I'm a bit confused. That's the U1 coupling. This is now just the internal gauge theory. In the internal gauge theory, it's just, I don't know that I think about it in terms of anomaly, it's just something I have to add to fix the lack of gauge invariance in the bulk. I mean, I guess it's saying the bulk is anomalous because this is not gauge invariant. It's gauge invariant up to a boundary, so that's the anomaly.
But that's the same, isn't that the same thing? I mean, it's gauge transformation is violated.
It's a gauge anomaly on the boundary.
Yeah, you can call it a gauge anomaly on the boundary, fine.
So it's, what's the gauge anomaly for the 2+1 dimensional direct terminal?
Well, but that's okay because this is not forced by, I mean, it has to be something that I can kill with time reversal symmetry. So it can't have a genuine anomaly. I mean, the anomalies cancel out, if you like. I mean, it'd be like if I had right mover and left mover. I mean, it's not different from the 1+1D case, I guess is the point I'm making. In the 1+1D case, I know that I can disappear the edge by time reversal. So there's no genuine anomaly there. Right?
There has to be this token between bulk and boundary, right? So that it kind of comes from anomaly.
Well, I guess the anomaly, if you want to, okay. The anomaly is that a single Dirac fermion with time reversal invariance cannot appear just as a surface. Sorry, cannot appear as an isolated 2D system. It has to come from a bulk. So you could put that in the language of an anomaly, I suppose, that I couldn't make it in isolation. So the point, I guess then the point would be that this gives me one Dirac fermion rather than two. And that's with time reversal. Without time reversal, it's easy to have one Dirac fermion.
Maybe one way to make it more explicit is if you consider a domain wall on the surface of two ways to break camera, so then you see a chiral exit, so you see that there is indeed some anomaly.
But you can understand, I mean, that will come out just if you have the E dot V term, right? You don't need anything.
So that shows there is an anomaly just hidden there, and that you can show there's an anomaly in the exit, in the surface.
Okay, but then there is an anomaly for the Dirac fermion, because I can do that with the single Dirac fermion.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like any theory that gives E dot B will describe that with the odd coefficient, and that is. So yeah, I just want to understand if this is the terminology question or if there's some.
No, well, maybe to rephrase, how does the boundary fermion transform under these gauge transformations?
The boundary bosons came from the bulk gauge transformation. The way I think about it is that the gauge transformation in the bulk is actually what became in the 1+1D case, the boson at the boundary. How to work from the gauge transformation for the boson to the fermion, I don't know.
It's probably some non-local.
That would be logical, yeah, that it's local for the boson and non-local for the fermion. Okay.
Question. So for the ordinary 1D bosonization, you have this, the condensed matter language, you have the constructive method built up from bosonic particle excitation put it onto the exponential. Is there a way for your bosonization built up in this way?
Well, there's one tricky thing there, which is a subtraction. So an example of something that should be sensitive to that would be like the specific heat. So for example, a good question, even a simpler version of correlation functions would be, if I've got a bunch of 1D bosons, if I bosonize along a ray, I would expect to get specific heat of T. But at the Dirac point, I should have specific heat of T squared. And it seems hard to add up a bunch of T's and get T squared. So what's happening is that there's a subtraction related to the fact that I normal ordered along rays, but I also need to do some careful ordering between rays. Or another way to look at it is I need to get rid of multiple counting of the occupied states. So I think that is probably doable, but we haven't done it. So I think there ought to be a way to do the subtraction properly and see that it's not actually T squared, it's not T, but rather T squared, if I treat the ground state properly. I mean, so what is faithfully represented here? This is the expression of the Dirac fermion operator in terms of the bosonic operators. Now, the ground state, how that gets taken, that's what would answer the question about specific heat, for example. Like, what does the Fermi C now look like in terms of the bosons? And that is more complicated than this, at least. I'm a bit pessimistic about being able to calculate too many fermionic things, because the moment I add, the powerful thing about one-dimensional bosonization is that local Fermi interactions become actually just quadratic terms for the boson. Here, that's not true. I mean, local interactions for the fermions they become non-local in the bosonic language. They couple different rays. So there's no way to handle interactions of the fermions. So in that sense, it's much, much weaker than 1+1D bosonization, as we'd expect.
So Hansen and Oganessian and Sundeep proposed BF theory as a description of S-wave superconductors in, say, 3+1 dimensions. But S-wave superconductors don't have a gapless surface mode. So, but you're proposing the same theory for topological instances.
Well, okay, so BF theory has a surface mode. And I asked Hansen, or at least it can with enough symmetry, and asked him, what do you think happens in the superconductor? And he said, well, somehow it must get gapped, but we don't know. So I don't really understand, but actually from talking with people here, there's a way to understand it in 2+1, which is that if you like, the modes that would be gapless would be like a combination of charge and vortex, like charge plus vortex going one way and charge minus vortex going the other way, if I take literally the A and B fields. And the problem is that the equivalent of time reversal symmetry, which is what protects the mode here, would become something pretty unphysical in terms of those degrees of freedom. So I guess all that BF theory is ever going to give are symmetry protected surface states. They're not, it's not like Chern-Simons where there just absolutely has to be a surface state. Here there's only a surface state with some symmetry. For the topological insulator case, that symmetry is natural. For spin liquids, it's moderately artificial. And my feeling is that for superconductors, it's tremendously artificial. So that, I suspect, is the difference in the three cases. But there are other things that I don't understand about the superconducting case. In particular, just even the statement that superconductors are topological, I'm somewhat bothered by for reasons we can talk about later. In the title of that paper is Superconductors Are Topologically Ordered. So the spin liquid part and the BF part of that paper I found extremely helpful, but there are things I don't get in the superconducting part, in particular, why there is no edge. I don't think anyone, any of the authors has given an answer to that.
No more questions? If not, let's thank Joe.